Because today, we're actually going to start learning the content of our faith, and this is so compressed. What we're going to share with you, myself and Father John, from now until March, is an overview of the basics of the Catholic faith. And our first class here today is almost one that, it almost seems like it doesn't need to exist, right? A class on the existence of God. If you didn't believe there's a God, you wouldn't be here, right? However, I think you're going to find this helpful for a number of reasons. One of the things this class is helpful for is answering this question. Why do we bother studying about our faith at all? Why bother? Once upon a time, I was bringing people into the faith, and there was this Hispanic couple, and I told them about classes before baptism, and they got kind of angry. I said, what are you angry about? And they said, clases, siempre clases. Spanish classes, always classes. And they raised a point that I think a lot of people have. Why do we bother studying? Why do you go to classes? Why? Very simple. You can't love what you don't know. And ultimately, the faith is about falling madly head over heels in love with the God who created you, who's already madly head over heels in love with you, even if you don't know it yet. But it's the greatest romance in the world. When you meet somebody and you're interested in them, don't you want to know about their past? Where'd you go to school? Where'd you grow up? You know, how many brothers and sisters do you have? What are your interests? You want to know more and more and more and more about them, because the more you know, the more you love. If you don't know, you can't possibly love. I remember once upon a time, I was living in a rectory with another priest who was from India. And he walked in one night on Monday Night Football. Hadn't the slightest idea what was going on. All he knew was cricket. So he walked in on the game and turns to all of us priests watching the football game, and he says, well, what sort of cricket is this? He says, this isn't cricket at all. This is football. He was absolutely baffled, and he walked out of the room in 5 minutes. Why did he walk out of the room in 5 minutes? Because he didn't know anything about it. You can't love what you don't know. That's why we study about our faith, okay? And there's another reason why we study about our faith, and this is equally important. And that is that studying about our faith clears up misunderstandings. And the Catholic faith, to most people in the world, is badly misunderstood. One misunderstanding after another. When you clear up these misunderstandings, it's like a eureka moment. And you say, oh, I never thought of it like that before. For example, the doctrine of hell. I've gotten more questions about hell from people over the years. Why would God create people just to send them to hell? He doesn't create people just to send them to hell. It's a great big misunderstanding. Why do we study about our faith? To clear up misunderstandings. Okay, so we're going to start today at the very beginning with a question you might not have taken the chance to think about, and that's the question of God's existence. Now think about this. Quite simply, God's existence is the most important question in the world. The most important question in the world. If God exists, then everything in the entire world takes its meaning in reference to God. And if God doesn't exist, last one out the room, don't forget to hit the lights. If God doesn't exist, you have to stop to consider all the things that follow as a consequence if God doesn't exist. If there's no God, if there's no truth, if there's no love, if there's no absolute anything, absolute right, telling us the difference between right and wrong, well, quite frankly, nothing has any meaning at all. You're nothing but your constituent elements. When you die, you just dissolve and go back into the earth. There's no right, there's no wrong, there's no justice. No matter how many people defrauded you in your life, no matter how many people you've defrauded in your life, if you got away with it scot-free, you got away with it, because there's no tribunal, there's no karma, there's no answering for anything that's happened. Absolutely nothing has any meaning whatsoever if there's no God. Fyodor Dostoevsky is one of my favorite authors. He's a Russian novelist. In his book, The Brothers Karamazov, he once said, if God does not exist, Everything is permissible. Just get away with whatever you can get away with. Eat, drink, and be merry, for tomorrow we die. The Greeks of ancient Athens knew that the gods of Mount Olympus weren't real, didn't actually exist. You could climb up Mount Olympus, they wouldn't actually be anybody there. And because they were philosophers and because they were thinkers, they thought about life and they thought about all the pain that we have to go through. And they made a calculation, a lot of them made a calculation that it just wasn't worth it. And they went into a public bath, opened up a vein, and committed the most painless suicide they possibly could. Simple calculation. If there's no ultimate meaning behind anything, then it's a pretty bleak picture out there. Now, Sigmund Freud, who I'm sure you've all heard of, Sigmund Freud, who was an atheist, thought that belief in God was a kind of insanity. Right? Give you a quick definition of insanity. Insanity is being out of touch with reality. Very quick definition of insanity. And if you believe that there's a God out there, and there's no, and of course he believes there's no God out there, and you're ordering your entire life around a great big myth. Who's ever heard of Jimmy Stewart? Who's ever heard of It's a Wonderful Life? Okay, old movie. The guy in It's a Wonderful Life is Jimmy Stewart. Jimmy Stewart made a movie called Harvey. Just curious, who's ever heard of the movie Harvey? Okay, old black and white movie about Jimmy Stewart, who is the only person in the entire world who sees this 7-foot rabbit. Nobody else can see him. And everybody thinks he's crazy because before he makes any decision, he consults with Harvey. Well, by the end of the movie, you realize Harvey's actually real. Right? He's not crazy after all. But if we're sitting here talking about God, and there is no God, we're all crazier than Jimmy Stewart in Harvey the Rabbit. Freud is right. It's a great big sort of insanity. And all we are is actors on a stage. Are we ad-libbing our lines? Or did somebody actually write this play? Let's take a closer look. Now, the very first thing we're going to do when talking about God's existence is talk about the atheist position that God doesn't exist. And you might be surprised to learn this, but there's only one argument in the world that God does not exist. Only one. And it's the argument from evil, which I'll talk about in just a moment. But if you talk to atheists, or if you look at atheist websites, or YouTube, or read atheist blogs, or any of these things, you will find all kinds of arguments against God, almost 100% of which don't say that God doesn't exist. They say either it's foolish that you believe this. Psychologically unhealthy, stunts your intellectual and emotional and personal growth, but doesn't actually come out and say, here's the facts and I'm going to prove to you that God doesn't exist. Almost 100% of atheist talk is how it's unhealthy to try to be fixated in this idea of a God. There's only one argument that God doesn't exist. Let's take a look at this right here, okay? It's the problem of evil. Now, evil exists. And the problem of evil is that that's one and only one proof that God does not exist. If you're a believer, evil is a problem, okay? If you're a believer, it's very difficult to explain things like school shootings and Hiroshima and etc., all the evil things that you see, in light of a God who's all-powerful, all-good, and all-knowing. It's a big problem. If you're an atheist, it's proof that there is no God. Now, let me give you three arguments against God's existence, all based on the problem of evil. You ready? Here's your first one. It's right here in your notes. First argument. This is all logic, by the way. If one of two opposites is infinite, the other can't exist. For example, if there's infinite light, can there be such a thing as darkness? No. If there's infinite darkness, can there be such a thing as light? No. If there's infinite cold, can there be such a thing as heat? No. If one of two opposites exists, the other cannot exist. But God means infinite goodness. If God exists, then God's opposite, evil, cannot exist. But evil does exist. Therefore, God does not. That's the first argument against God's existence. Okay, you ready? Here's the second. If God exists, then God is all-powerful and all-good, because that's what we mean by God. one whose goodness and power are unlimited. If God were all good, he would only will good and not evil. If God were all powerful, he'd get anything he wants. Therefore, if God exists, everything should be good. But everything is not good. Therefore, God must not exist. That's the second argument. Okay, here's the third. If God is all good, he loves us. If he loves us, he wants us to be happy. If he's all powerful, God gets anything that he wants. But we're not happy. Therefore, if God exists, he's either bad or weak. And that is not God. Okay? There's a subspecies of atheism I've got here in your notes called process theology. I won't get into it right now, but it's this idea that, you know, God's like a teenage God. He's still growing up. He hasn't quite matured yet, and he's still getting a few things wrong. As we'll see in just a moment here, that doesn't square with the idea of who we say God is. Now, these arguments weren't formulated by atheists. Every single argument that I gave you came from a believer. The first come from St. Thomas Aquinas. The second comes from St. Augustine. And the third comes from C.S. Lewis. You heard about the Chronicles of Narnia? Everybody know about Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe? Author of the Chronicles of Narnia. Interestingly enough, there's a professor at Boston College, and every year he has his students write an essay. And the project goes something like this. He asks the students to raise their hand to see whether they believe in God or not. And all the students who raise their hand and say they believe in God, their project is to write an essay about why God does not exist. And all the students who raise their hand and say they do not believe in God, their project is to write an essay on why God exists. And year after year, he does this. And the results are always the same. The believers who are told to argue that God does not exist come up with the most incredible, convincing statements about how it couldn't be possible that there could be a God when there's murders and suicide and child sacrifice and all these awful things, and how could God possibly exist? It's just the most, they argue it better than the atheists could argue it. And the atheists, their essays are always the same. It's always like, you know, there's like a tooth fairy in the sky and he grants your wishes and really, really weak stuff. And then he reveals the results to the students and he says, do you know why this is the case? Why is this the case? And the atheists, they all say, well, it's because you gave us something impossible as a task. I mean, how am I supposed to argue that there's not a God, that there's a God when clearly there's not? And he says, no, that's not it at all. It's that the believers understand your point of view and you do not understand their point of view. If you understand this point of view, I think it pretty much settles the question, which is what I'm going to try to do with you here, okay? A response to the problem of evil. All three of those arguments that I gave you, they're very logical. Now, if you want to disprove something, let me give you a real quick study in logic here, okay? I hope this finds this helpful. There's three ways you can disprove something if somebody gives you an argument. Number one, you can say there's false premises. Number two, you can say there's faulty logic. Or number three, you can say there's ambiguous terms. Let me explain. False premises. You can make anything you want true if you use false premises. For example, here's a false premise. All priests can fly like Superman. I'm a priest. Therefore, I can fly like Superman. Now, you know it's false, but the logic isn't false. Do you follow? It's just a stupid premise. If I start with a stupid premise, I can prove anything. Secondly, faulty logic. Here's an example of faulty logic. Everyone who lives in Ashburn lives in Virginia. I don't live in Ashburn. Oh, well, then you don't live in Virginia. Faulty logic, right? Third way you can disprove something, ambiguous terms. Banks are a safe place for money. Rivers have banks. Therefore, riverbanks are a safe place for money. Ambiguous terms. It's what do you mean by the word bank? Okay. Now, when you take a look at those arguments from evil, the premises are true. There's nothing false about what I stated. And the logic is tight. Therefore, if you want to answer an atheist, you have to argue on ambiguous terms. And here's where ultimately atheism and the arguments fall apart. They make mistakes as to what they mean by God and what they mean by evil. Okay? What an atheist means when they speak of God is not the same thing we believe when we speak of God. And secondly, evil is not a permanent final state. I could talk more about that, but it would be spirituality. God always draws a greater good from it. I'm not going to get into that right now. Instead, we're going to first talk about what we mean by God, okay? Most atheists will say that God is the greatest being in the universe. In fact, a lot of Christians would say God is the greatest being in the universe. That's their understanding of God. You know, like there's got to be somebody who's the tallest student in the eighth grade, right? There's got to be somebody who's the fastest runner in high school. There's got to be somebody, I don't know, who is the best at math, the greatest, the most superlative, the tallest mountain, the deepest ocean. God's like that too. God's just the greatest being in the universe. We do not believe that God is the greatest being in the universe. You want to know why? Understand this. We do not believe that God is a being in the universe. You have to let that one sink in. God is not a being in the universe. Our understanding of God is that God is the very act of existence itself. You may at some point ask yourself a question. Why is there something rather than nothing? Maybe you've asked that of yourself. I don't know. Just curious. How many people have ever kind of pondered, why is there something rather than nothing? Sometimes you sort of think, well, why am I here? And why is any of this here? And why is there even existence at all? Like, where does this come from? What we actually say when we talk about the nature of God is that God is the actual force of existence itself. God is not a being in the universe, as if there's like a universe out there and God's just like the biggest thing in it. If you think that is what we mean by God, you'll end up being an atheist, okay? But God once told Moses his name. Do you know the story of Moses and the burning bush? Raise your hand if you heard the story of Moses and the burning bush. Raise your hand if you've never heard the story of Moses and the burning bush. It's in the book of Exodus. And Moses meets God for the very first time. And he sees this bush burning, and it's not burning up. And he's very curious. What the heck? And he starts dialoguing with the Spirit. Now, Moses comes from Egypt, where there's Ra, the sun god, and Isis, you know, the goddess of whoever, and all these pantheons of gods. And so God says, I'm the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. He goes, oh, that's interesting. One more god to add to the collection. What's your name? Right? It's not going to be Isis. Your name's not going to be Ra. What's your name? And God answered Moses by saying, my name is I Am. My name is I Am existence itself. I am the one who is. That's the nature of God. Now, another thing to talk about when we're talking about the existence of God is this. There is no silver bullet argument that can end all doubt whatsoever. Because believe me, if there was, somebody would have already thought it up by now. Okay? When we talk about the existence of God, rather, it goes something like this. Imagine if I could give you a sliver of evidence, and I could add another sliver of evidence to that, and I could add another sliver of evidence to that, and I could keep going until I've added up a lot of slivers and made quite a compelling argument, any one of which you could pick apart if you wanted to, but taken together, they're actually something. That's what arguing for God's existence is all about. Everything that I can give you are slivers of evidence, but you know they add up. There's another thing to talk about when talking about God's existence. Logically and reasonably, I cannot simply explain to you everything from the Bible that we believe about God. It's just too big. It's just too much. And that's not even my attempt right now. So for example, people could say, yeah, but I was reading the Old Testament and God told Moses to slay the Amalekites. And, you know, but he said also, thou shalt not kill. And I don't know how to figure those things out. I cannot give you an entire class in biblical scholarship. It's just too much. And that's not even what I'm trying to do right now. I'm only trying to make it reasonable to believe, to understand that it makes more sense to say that there is a God than to say that there's not a God. That's the whole point, all right? That's the whole point. So, who is God? What is God? Well, God is a spirit who's infinite, omnipresent, eternal, omniscient, omnipotent, and omnibenevolent. That's what we mean. Let's go through what those things are. First of all, God is a spirit. What's a spirit? Well, you have a lot of knowledge of spirit right now, right where you sit. Want to know why? Because you are spirit. You are. You're a spirit and a body in one. You're not a spirit trapped in a body, and you're not a spirit who has a body. You're one being, and you're spirit and body. And the spirit in you knows and loves. That's what spirit does. Spirit knows and loves. So what does God do? God knows. What does God do? God loves. What's the perfection of knowing? Knowing the truth. What's the perspective of choosing? Is loving. But you have a spirit right now, and it's part of you. For example, you have courage. If I asked you, how much does your courage weigh? What color is it? How long is it? How high is it? What's its dimensions? You'd say, well, that doesn't make any sense. Courage doesn't have weight and height and length and dimension and color. It's something that's inside of you. And I say, yeah, that's part of your spirit. Now, physical things, we can talk about how long your hair is, how old you are, how much you weigh, you know, how many wrinkles you have, how many wrinkles your wrinkles have, all these things. That's all physical. But your spirit is everything about you that's not physical. And when we talk about God, we're not talking about something physical. We're saying God is a spirit. He has no shape, size, color, weight, doesn't occupy space. God is two things, knowing and willing. In other words, he's perfect truth and he's perfect love. That's what we mean by God. Secondly, he's infinite. There's no limit whatsoever. Every attribute of God is infinite. God doesn't just have knowledge. God is knowledge. God doesn't just have power. God is power. God doesn't just have goodness. God is goodness. And all of this infinitely. Absolutely every perfection. And God never changes. God doesn't change his mind. He's not going to be different next year from last year. The one who is, the one who was, and the one who is to come, by definition, can't change, because any change would be a change for the worse. Okay? The other thing that God is omnipresent and eternal. The words where and when don't apply to God. God is always. God is yesterday, God is now, God is also tomorrow. Which is the subject matter of a lot of good prayer, by the way. I always like to tell people, don't dwell in the past. God's got it covered. Don't dwell in the future. God's already there. It's going to be just fine. God is a constant, permanent is. And there's nowhere where God is not. You climb to the heavens, he's there. If you go to the depths of the oceans, he's there. That's a real brief understanding of what we mean by God. Now, there are two big arguments for God's existence, and they're on your notes. Number one is what we call cosmological reasons, and number two is what we call psychological reasons. Cosmological reasons means from the world around us. Psychological reasons means from your own experience. Let's go over a few, okay? We're going to start with, how do we know God exists from looking at the world around us? Okay, here's a big one, is causality. And you have to think about these things. I hope this isn't too much to throw at you all at once. But everything that exists came from somewhere. You got your notes in your hand, and you don't have to wonder where they came from. You know where they came from. Where'd they come from? I wrote them. And I used a Xerox machine, and I printed them, and the secretary across the hall, bless her heart, stapled them because the stapler and the copier didn't work today. Okay? But you know where they come from. Everything comes from somewhere. If you were to find a $100 bill on this desk when you walked in, and you were honest, you'd recognize somebody somewhere lost that. They didn't just leave it there by chance. It came from somewhere. It has a cause. You are here because you have parents. Your parents are here because they had parents. The whole universe is a vast interlock of causes. But does the universe itself have a cause? Is there anything that just flat out exists that's not caused by anything? And the answer is yes. That's part of what we mean by God. Okay? Otherwise, you've got causes caused by things like a great big chain link, each chain, link of the chain held together by the previous chain, but it's never actually hanging on anything. It just keeps going on forever and ever and ever without any explanation, without any cause. That doesn't make sense. One of the things we say when we talk about God's existence is just existence itself. So far, so good? So for example, if talking to somebody who doesn't believe in God, you could just talk about this. Just this and nothing else. Why is there even anything here? Well, it just is. Okay, that doesn't make any sense. Why does it just is? What caused it? It just always was. Why? Everything has a cause. So that's the thing, the first thing to stop and realize when we talk about God, from reasons from the world around us, causality. Now here's a big one. order. Things don't come about by chance. Something ordered it. If I were to take you to a museum, let's all go to the National Gallery in D.C., and I were to show you a lovely painting on the wall, and you were to say, that's the most prettiest painting I've ever seen. Who painted it? And if I were to respond to you, nobody painted it. You know, there was a great big paint factory one day across the street, and some movers were taking a blank canvas, and the paint factory blew up. Ink flew all across the world, and it landed on the canvas. And they said, boy, that looks great. Let's put a frame around it. You'd say, no, that doesn't make any sense. That doesn't happen by chance. Another one of my favorite examples. For those of you old enough to remember 1976, and don't volunteer, I don't need to know, okay? But they sent a probe to Mars in 1976. First ever probe they sent to Mars. And as they were flying across the surface of Mars, they took pictures of the surface. And you can look this up, Face on Mars, Viking 1, 1976. The shadows fell across these valleys and hills and looked just like a human face. And then that picture got picked up by NASA and they published it in the newspapers. And what did people say the next morning when they saw the pictures from Mars that looked like a human face? What did they all say? Life on Mars, somebody made a monument, right? Well, it turns out that it was just the interplay of light and shadow when you saw from a different angle. It didn't look like it. But everyone assumed that there was a design, there was a designer. If you were flying overhead in an airplane and you looked out your window across the South Pacific as you were making your way, let's say you're going to Australia, and down there, far, far down below, you see a lone deserted island through the clear blue sky. And on the beach, three letters spelled out in logs, S-O-S. You say to yourself, oh, there's a castaway. Somebody's in trouble. You do not say to yourself, oh, isn't that fascinating? Logs happen to wash up on the shore and form the letters S-O-S. So far, so good. Where there's design, there's a designer. Now, look at the world around you and tell me if this just explains itself. I've got plenty of examples. I can't get into them all. Thousands of bats take off from one cave all instantaneously. They never run into each other. Honeycomb of a bee. Hexagonal form holds the most possible honey with the least expenditure of wax. Black pole warbler, it's a kind of bird, travels 2,400 miles from Nova Scotia to South America, nonstop on the wing for 4 days and four nights with an estimated fuel efficiency of 720,000 miles to the gallon. A 747, by contrast, gets 6 gallons to the mile. There's example upon example of these amazingly things. A 1979 study, one of my favorites, Smithsonian, across 6 years, monitored 93 different migrations of birds across 500 miles. 91 out of 93 bird migrations avoided all bad weather. Somehow, before these birds ever left shore, they calculated the weather days, weeks, and even months in advance, hundreds of miles away. It's almost like it's got a designer, right? The human brain, 100 billion neurons. As many stars as there are in the galaxy, line it up end to end, it would stretch 124 million miles and circle the Earth 5,000 times. And each synapse in your brain, even this moment as you're listening to me, is firing at a rate of 268 miles an hour. It can form 100 trillion calculations in a second, which even to this day is 2,000 times faster than the fastest home computer. It does all of this on 10 watts of power and at 75% water. It's as though it's stamped with a trademark that says made by superhuman intelligence. One single human cell contains more information than the entire Library of Congress. There's plenty more examples here that I could go into, all of which are on your notes. But real briefly, let me just scan over them. Life on this Earth. You've probably heard it said before that there's so many galaxies and so many stars and so many. Certainly somewhere out there, there's got to be not only a planet like Earth, but lots of planets like Earth. Well, it turns out that there's a whole segment of science that says it's so improbable that there was that anything like this could ever happen. It's improbable that it ever happened even once. The oxygen in the air, it was 4% less you couldn't breathe. It was 4% more the atmosphere would spontaneously combust. The tilt of the Earth's axis, exactly 23.5 degrees. 1% more, 1% less, summer, winter would be inhospitable. It would be 100 degrees hotter or colder. There's hundreds of these variables, and if any one of which wasn't perfect, life wouldn't be possible. Another one that's really amazing is the moon. You ever look at a map of the solar system and you see all the planets and all the moons? There's one thing really unusual about the Earth. The moon is huge compared to the size of the planet. It's almost like it's a binary planetary system. The moon is huge. And there's all these theories about how the moon formed and things like that. But I mean, a moon the size that Earth has, most planets like the size of Saturn have moons like that. And it turns out that if we didn't have a moon that big, we wouldn't have the tidal forces that we have, and we wouldn't have the interplay of land and water that allowed life to develop in the first place. Smaller moon never would have happened. Who knows what would have happened, but it certainly wouldn't be what we have now. I've got a whole thing in here about Charles Darwin and natural selection, and I'm not going to get into it because it's too complicated. But whereas Charles Darwin and talked about, you know, how certain things can evolve, they can't evolve that much. There are certain things that have what's called irreducible complexity, like a mousetrap, for example. I can't evolve a mousetrap. All the parts have to all be there at once or the whole thing doesn't work. It can't gradually become like that. Certain things can gradually become like that. Darwin bred finches. He was a breeder of birds. And he realized that he could breed these birds to make certain beaks longer or shorter. And you know, he was out on the Galapagos Islands where there was this drought, and these certain kinds of finches, they died because their beaks weren't long enough to get through the hard shell of these fruits to get to the soft nutrients inside. And the beaks and the birds with long beaks survived. Natural selection works at that level, but it doesn't work at the level of developing a cell. And if you, certainly many of you know more about cells and biology than I do, but you know that, you know, our modern understanding of a cell is it has the complexity of a small city. All the parts of which all have to be working, one of which not being in place, the whole thing begins to fall apart. So you know it's like someone designed this. And if you look at it, you begin to say, this makes a great deal of sense. Can I throw one more thing out at you here? And it's mathematics. Have you ever heard it said before that if you had 1 billion monkeys and you gave them 1 billion typewriters and you gave them 1 billion years, eventually one of those monkeys would, by pure chance, happen to pound out, say, War and Peace by Lev Tolstoy, just by pure chance? Yeah, if you have enough monkeys and you have enough typewriters, you have enough years, one of them will certainly, you know, write the entire Oxford English Dictionary just by pure random chance. Answer, no, they won't. There was a mathematician at Rice University who did a study on this. 1 in 30 random keystrokes will produce a 3-letter English word. The chance of having a 12-letter English word are 1 in 10 to the 14. There's 10 to the 14 minutes in 1 billion years. And the chance of randomly typing out a sentence that's 100 letters long by random keystrokes is 1 in 10 to the 130. There's only 10 to the 76 atoms in the known universe. So, no, 1 billion monkeys with 1 billion years and 1 billion typewriters would not. You give it these things enough time and enough probability, limits begin to kick in, and these things don't just happen by chance. So that's part of those are a couple of the biggest cosmological reasons for God's existence from the world around us. Let me throw you one more. And this is one you don't often hear about. It's the argument from saints. And the argument goes something like this. If there's saints, there's got to be a saint maker. Now, I encourage all of you to learn about the saints. In fact, if you progress and if you stick with this and if you want sacraments and confirmation and you want to become Catholic and all these things, you're going to pick a patron saint. And you're going to want to pick somebody who means something to you. Learn about the saints and learn about their lives. You will be amazed. Not that these people are greatly talented or greatly smart or greatly physically beautiful or anything else. They were greatly good. They had greatly good souls. And the argument from saints says, where'd they get that? Now, if you take all these saints together and you ask, what do they all have in common? You'll discover one thing they all have in common. They all believed in God. Question for you here this evening. Were they onto something? Or were they all the most deluded fools? I can tell you stories. St. Maximilian Kolbe. Who's ever heard of Auschwitz prison? Everybody knows about the infamous concentration camp. Once upon a time in 1940, a prisoner escaped from Auschwitz prison. They never found him. And the Nazi guards, who are not known for being nice people, decided to make an example to all the rest of the prisoners that no one else would ever try to escape from Auschwitz prison. They literally decimated the prison. That is to say, they counted off by tens, and every 10th person was killed. And not just killed, but killed in the starvation bunker. I've been to Auschwitz prison in Poland. And there's a room, about a quarter of the size of this room, and they pack, picture this, pack the room filled with human bodies, lock the door, and leave you to die. And you talk about a bad way to go, right? No light, no food, no water, no room. Just you stuffed in with people until you're all dead. The starvation bunker. And they counted off 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10. You to the starvation bunker. And away they would go, and away they would go, counting off by tens. 7, 8, 9. I don't know whether people were shuffling around and making sure they weren't number 10 or whatever they were doing, but they called on number 10, and the guy fell to his knees. And he says, I have to survive. I've got a wife, I've got a family. They promised me that if I worked, I would be freed, that I would be set free. They promised me, I have to survive, I have to survive. Maximilian Kolbe was a Catholic priest, and he stepped forward. He was number 11. And he says, I'll go if you let him live. And the Nazi guard was nonplussed. Nobody'd ever volunteered to die before. And he says, who do you think you are? And he says, I'm a Catholic priest. I died the day I was ordained. And he went to the starvation bunker of his own free will. And not only that, but he brought peace and joy to everybody in their last days. Picture this, a room stuffed with people in the dark, and they're all singing hymns of praise to God. Who did that? Maximilian Kolbe did that. That's a saint. These people are greatly good. I can give you more and more and more examples of saints. Mother Teresa of Calcutta, picking people up out of, off the streets because she thinks they deserve to die a dignified death, bringing them back to their home for dying destitutes in Calcutta, washing their wounds, giving them something to eat, giving them something to drink. One man, as he's dying, turns to Mother Teresa, looks her in the eyes, and asks, is God like you? And her answer? No, but I try to be like him. Where do these people get goodness like that? It certainly isn't from, reading self-help books. They've all got one thing in common. They all believed in God. Question for you. Were they all most deluded fools, or were they onto something? It's an argument, all right? Something to think about. The argument from saints. There's tons of arguments, tons of saints that I could give you stories of. Read them for yourself. All right. The second category is psychological reasons, and these are reasons from our own experience. Let me try to throw some of these out at you. Here's one, and I hope this makes sense because I really like this argument. It's called the argument from desire. Now consider this. Right there where you sit, you have all kinds of desires. All kinds of desires. Let's talk about the simplest ones. Everybody wants to breathe. Everybody wants to eat. Everybody wants to sleep. Everybody wants to have something to drink. Guess what? For all these natural, universal desires, there are real corresponding things to satisfy those desires. Now, there are certain desires you have for which there are not corresponding things to satisfy them, but if you think about those ones, you'll realize you made them up in your mind. Maybe you dream of being the MVP of the Super Bowl. Maybe you dream of winning the NBA slam dunk contest. Maybe you dream of flying through the air like Superman. Whatever it is, it's a figment of your imagination. You're dreaming it up, okay? And it's particular to you. But when I talk about desires, I'm talking about this. Imagine desires that everybody has. Absolutely everybody, not one single exception. For whatever it is that everybody desires, there's a real thing in this world to satisfy that desire. Correct? So far, so good? Okay. Except for one. And that one goes something like this. There's a desire in your heart for something more. You're not satisfied no matter what you get. Maybe you are for an hour or two, but do you remember what it was like when you were growing up as a kid and Christmas morning rolled around and, oh, you anticipated Christmas and how happy you were going to be when you finally got your gifts. And Christmas rolled around and you opened up the gifts and it was good for a little while, but at the end of the day, you said, I'm disappointed somehow and I can't quite put my finger on it. Does that sound familiar? Life is an experience of that happening over and over and over. Some people say to themselves, oh, if only I marry her, then I'll finally be happy. And then they get married. Don't tell me what it's like after that, okay? But it's not eternal bliss. If only I get into this school. If only I get this job. If only I can finally pay off this debt. If only I can finally make a 7-figure salary instead of a 6-figure salary, I'll finally be happy. And you get it. You reach for the brass ring and you get it. Tell me, what happens? Do you not very briefly rejoice? But then after it, say, huh, I thought this would make me happy, but this isn't it either. There's a universal desire for something more. There was a song by a group called Switchfoot a bunch of years back called "We Want More Than This World Has to Offer." And everybody sang it because everybody does want more than this world. It's a universal desire. What I would like to suggest to you from the argument from the desire is this. If every universal desire has something out there real corresponding that fulfills it, then there's a real something out there, a real something more that really will fulfill this desire you have in your heart for something more. And that something is God. There's something more than this world, and that something more isn't in this world. It's beyond this world. An argument from your own existence, from your own experience, okay? Another one is conscience. This is really fascinating, but have you ever noticed that even the worst people in the world always try to justify themselves and say that they did the right thing? I mean, the worst people. Who's ever heard of Hermann Göring? Hermann Göring was head of the Luftwaffe. He was head of Hitler's Air Force. And he was on trial for war crimes after World War II. And they showed him devastated cities. They showed him video from the concentration camps, all these things. And he turned to his lawyer and he said, 50 years from this day, there will be statues to my memory all across Germany. He was convinced to the last that he was a great man. And this is something that you find all across the world. Only in movies do you find villains twisting their mustache, right, and going, I'm going to go do evil. Nobody, right? Only in movies and comedy movies at that. Why is it that everybody in prison is innocent? Every last person in prison is innocent, right? Lawyer screwed me over every single time. Why do people always, no matter what they do, try to justify themselves and say that they're doing the right thing? If there isn't somewhere deep down in your heart some kind of tribunal, some kind of judge in your heart that knows you're not allowed to do wrong, you're supposed to do right, and you cannot violate this rule. It's in your heart right now as you sit. Where does that come from? Who put that there? Why can't you go do evil, smile, and get away with it? Why do you have to constantly justify yourself? The argument from conscience says that there actually is existing a real binding authority that demands absolute obedience. This is what we call God. It's why we always think we should do good. And no matter what people do, they always try to justify themselves, right? Beauty. This one's kind of, you either get this one or you don't. I had a friend who was hiking in the Alps in Germany. He was an atheist. And there was a rainstorm in the Alps as he was hiking. And after the rainstorm, a rainbow across the German Alps with the snow-capped peaks and the sun setting across a distant castle. And it was the most beautiful thing he'd ever seen. He says, you know, it almost made me believe in God. Almost. There's something about beauty that makes you stop and think there's more to this world than what my mathematics can add up and what my science tells me I can weigh in a scale. Take a newborn baby, put it in someone's arms. They're sort of taken out of themselves. You either get that one or you don't. It's a sign. There's something propelling you beyond this world to a something more. It's a revelation of God. That's actually what it is. Another thing is our need for a why. Now consider this. We're going to go back to another example from Auschwitz prison. Viktor Frankl, he was a Viennese psychiatrist. He wrote a book called Man's Search for Meaning, and he was an Auschwitz prisoner. And this is what he noticed in the concentration camp. The prisoners who survived were not the strongest, they were not the healthiest. Plenty of strong, healthy people taken to concentration camps died, and plenty of weak, sick people survived. What he found was that the ones who survived were the ones who had the most reason to keep going. For example, some prisoners were given tasks to do, like repair a broken fence or dig a new latrine. Other prisoners were given tasks that had no meaning whatsoever. Take this rusted out hulk of what used to be a truck and move it to that side of the camp. And tomorrow we're going to move the truck back. No meaning whatsoever. And that was their labor for the day. The ones who had meaning survived. The ones who didn't have meaning didn't survive. There's a need that we have for a reason, for a why. And we can endure anything if we know the reason for it. When you're sitting in a traffic jam, do you not immediately search for some kind of information source to tell you how long is this going to last? Right? And if it's going to last quick, you don't worry about it. If you have no knowledge, you're filled with frustration because you have a suffering, but you don't have a why. We can endure almost anything with a reason. We need life to be meaningful. Why do we need life to be meaningful? If there's no meaning to be discovered, why do we keep wanting it to be meaningful? And if there's no God, there's no meaning to be discovered. It's an argument for God's existence. Okay. Now, there's many other things I could go into, but I don't want to belabor the point. I think you get it. You can go on and on and on about this. Now, let me tee you up for next week's class by saying this. I can know God exists from thinking about things like this. I might not necessarily know God's a Trinity, or that God is Jesus Christ, or that God commanded 10 commandments, but I can know there's a God, okay? That's all this is trying to point to. In fact, you know, it's a teaching of our faith that you don't need faith to believe in God. All you need is reason. If you're reasonable and you look at the world and you look at yourself, you'll conclude it makes more sense to know there's a God than to know there's not a God. It takes more faith to believe this is all by chance and to explain all those things away. It takes more faith. However, knowing God exists isn't enough. So what we believe as Catholics is that God reached out to us and told us about himself. We call this divine revelation. That's what you're going to learn about next week in class, okay? Divine revelation. God revealed himself by certain select people, you know, and inspired them to write the scriptures. And God revealed himself by forming communities. In the Old Testament, the community of the Israelites. In the New Testament, the community of the church. Because he knew that left to our own devices, we wouldn't figure out the specifics. And God wanted us to know the specifics because he wanted us to know him and he wanted us to love him. That's what next week's class is all about, okay? So from the existence of God to next week's topic, which is divine revelation. Do you have any questions about anything from this evening?